Having this much power can be addictive. Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Alo Hudson, Associate Professor of the Department of City and Regional Planning at UC Berkeley, and the moderator for today's program. This program is underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. In recent years, there has been growing scientific evidence indicating a connection between public health and how places, particularly our cities and suburbs, are designed and built. From higher car use and suburban sprawl to urban neighborhoods lacking green space and walkways, every aspect of the built environment surrounding us impacts our health. What is being done to rethink the structure of our towns and cities? How can we improve the health of our communities through design? Today, we will talk about our cities, our health, and what we can do to increase the number of healthy spaces in our growing communities. I'm now pleased to introduce our distinguished panel. To my right is Lisa Chin. She develops long-range plans and policies at the San Francisco Planning Department. She works on sustainable neighborhood planning, community development, active transportation, and economic and fiscal analysis. Some of her current and past projects include the Health Services Master Plan Update, the Transportation Sustainability Program, the Central SoMa Area Plan, and the Green Connections Plan. Previously, Lisa worked as a planner at the nonprofit Change Lab Solutions, where she provided technical assistance to government and community stakeholders around the country on policy strategies to support public health. She holds a BA in architecture and a dual master's degree from UC Berkeley in city planning and public health, and one of my former students, one of the best students I ever had. So. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
On the right of Lisa is Dr. Richard Jackson, who is both a medical doctor and professor and former chair of environmental health sciences at the Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. A pediatrician, he has served in many leadership positions in both environmental health and infectious disease with the California Health Department, including as a state health officer. For 9 years, he was director of the CDC's National Center for Environmental Health and received the Presidential Distinguished Service Award. Welcome, Dr. On Dr. Jackson's right is Fran Weld. With the San Francisco Giants. She is Vice President of Strategy and Development. She is responsible for managing the design, financing, and entitlements of Mission Rock, a mixed-use public-private partnership between the Giants and the city and port of San Francisco. Mission Rock will be a 28-acre waterfront neighborhood that will include 8 acres of parks. Fran sits on the board of directors of SPUR and holds a BS in physics from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and an MBA with a concentration in public management from Stanford's Graduate School of Business. And at the very end is Bill Worthen, founding principal of Urban Fabric, Inc., a nationally recognized sustainability and collaborative design leader. In his 20-year career, Bill has balanced policy development with professional and public advocacy, practice experience, industry research, and peer-to-peer education. Bill served as a member of San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom's Green Building Task Force and is a current member of the San Francisco Eco District Formation Task Force. Let's please welcome all of our distinguished panelists. So I thought the best way to start would give you all a broad question. And from your perspective, how do you each view the relationship between open space and public health? So take a few minutes. Lisa, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here with this great set of panelists, and thank you all for coming to support parks and our health. So we've known for a long time about the relationship between parks and our health. Frederick Law Olmsted, of course, he coined the famous term lungs of the city to describe Central Park and how and how it really serves as this restorative function in this dense urban environment. Similarly, I really think that parks should serve as the heart of our cities. They're one of the truly open and democratic spaces in our cities where people of all different backgrounds and cultures can come together and create a sense of community, which we know is critical to both our mental and our physical health. And you can really see this on display in a lot of San Francisco's signature open spaces like Golden Gate Park, Dolores Park, Crissy Field, where you can really see people engaging in a diverse array of activities, everything from exercise to dance classes to cultural events, or just sitting and enjoying nature and people watching. However, even though we have really great parks in San Francisco, the city has recognized that we need to do more to ensure that people in all neighborhoods have access to safe and welcoming open spaces. I really saw this need firsthand when I was working, prior to becoming a planner, developing school garden programs for middle and high school youth in San Francisco. I was stunned to realize that some of my students who had grown up in the city had never been to Golden Gate Park and had never seen the ocean. So our programs were really trying to bridge this gap in simple and creative ways. So we would have, school gardens that were very simple, maybe just a few raised beds that volunteers and teachers would look after. And we would come in and do cooking and gardening demos. And so this kind of brings me to the main point that I hope you'll take away from tonight, which is there are a lot of creative ways that we can infuse existing neighborhoods with more opportunities for parks and open spaces. And we think about this at the planning department from a variety of scales and in different settings. So, of course, we partner with developers like the Giants and with our parks department and others to create new neighborhood parks. We also, when new development projects come in for, say, a building or a set of buildings, we'll make sure that they're integrating really high-quality open spaces, both private and public. But there's other opportunities, too. One opportunity that I think is often overlooked is our street network. So people may not realize that 25% of our land area in the city is devoted to streets, which is more than our entire public open space network. So there are opportunities to reclaim and reutilize some of this space to create spaces for gathering. Our Pavement to Parks program is a great example of this, where their strategy is to identify places like parklets, so former parking spaces, or street plazas, where they can put into place temporary interventions that are low cost, and that really kind of change the way we think about public open spaces, and kind of build momentum for maybe long-term permanent improvements in the future. Another project that I want to mention is the Green Connections Plan, which is a 20-year plan that envisions a network of 115 miles of trails that will be facilitate walking and biking to our parks and open spaces. The trails are really designed to serve three different functions. So first, increasing accessibility and active transportation to our parks. Second, increasing urban greenery and ecology. And third, bringing neighbors together to really participate in the design and care of these spaces. Quesada Avenue in the Bayview neighborhood is a great example of a street that accomplishes all three. And that was not a city project. So what happened was Quesada Avenue in the Bayview was really known as a street that had rampant drug dealing and illegal dumping. And neighbors came together and were fed up, so they decided to convert a wide median in the center of the street into this beautiful community garden that has public artwork and just opportunities to stop and enjoy and be in nature. And it's really contributed to a greater sense of pride and safety. One of the lessons we've really learned from examples like that is that partnerships with diverse stakeholders make a big difference. And so I just want to close with one other example of a public space that illustrates this fact, but also highlights some of the huge challenges we're facing in the city, particularly in this moment of unprecedented growth and change. So it's no secret that one of the issues that is at the top of many San Franciscans' minds is the growing affordability crisis and this sense that the city is becoming more divided. And as people move into the city, sometimes with higher incomes, there's this feeling that maybe we shouldn't have to see poverty in our street or people who are suffering with mental illness or drug abuse. And I want to push back on that because I really feel like now more than ever, our parks and open spaces have to serve this democratizing role because they are our only really public, truly public open venues for seeing people from other incomes and cultures. And I think one space that illustrates this perfectly is Civic Center and UN Plaza, which is, as we know, one of the most challenging spaces in the city. So right now, we're in the process of developing a public realm plan that is going to re-envision how the plaza looks and the streets around it. And I spoke with one of the lead urban designers on the project, and he acknowledged that many of the strategies we've turned to in the past have failed, and so we need to think of new strategies. So for example, in the 1970s, well-meaning city employees removed all the public seating, thinking that it would create safer spaces. But of course, we know that that didn't solve the problem, and it only served to make them more unwelcome for everybody. So as part of this effort, there are some temporary improvements that are happening and that will continue to happen through the planning process. If you haven't been to the plaza recently, I recommend you go out there now because there's a partnership with the Exploratorium, the mayor's office, and the planning department through our Living Innovation Zone project. And they've created a temporary art installation called the Sound Commons Project. And essentially, what it is a series of movable, interactive sculptures that allow you to experience sound and to understand how sound works. And I think the key part of that project and what has made it so successful is those partnerships. So the city has actually worked with nonprofit organizations who are out there. They've hired stewards and ambassadors who are coming from a few different programs. So there are formerly homeless as well as formerly incarcerated employees who are getting job training and who are also out there explaining how the project works and making sure that everything is safe. And I will just say, I was out there on Friday afternoon. It was a beautiful day, and there were kids and families out there, and that is a big change for that space. So I'll stop there because I know we have a lot of other topics to cover, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So I thought I had gone to heaven. I got into the University of California Medical School back in the late 1960s. I discovered that down the hill from Parnassus Heights was a spectacular park with a glass building and fuchsia plants, and one could go for a run and pass Buffalo and get, not the city of Buffalo, and get to the ocean and run down the ocean. We could do this in about an hour, and that space, which mentally was conceived a bit by Frederick Law Olmsted, is such a gift. Back by then, by the way, they still allowed cars through the park on Sundays. Things have changed a lot. When I went, at that point, I became a pediatrician, so I did both medical school and my residency in pediatrics there. Only about 5% of our kids could be classified as being overweight or obese in the U.S. population. When I went to the Children's Diabetes Clinic, I never saw a child with adult-onset diabetes. Now, half the kids in that clinic have type 2 diabetes related to obesity. One-third of the adults in America now are obese, and another one-third are classified as overweight. We've seen an enormous increase, about 27 pounds in every single American adult since that time. Average 14-year-olds about 14 pounds heavier. Gaining weight, you know, that's a challenge. We all kind of have to struggle with that one. But the other part of this is this epidemic of physical inactivity. So 25 years ago, when they profiled how physically active American adults are, Malo's age, only about 56% of the people in the United States, adults, got enough physical activity every single day. Now, we doctors have been waving our hands at people for the last 30 years telling people, you got to walk, you got to exercise. You're not going to be able to control this. Yes, worry about your weight, but you have to be physically active for your heart, for your kidneys, for diabetes prevention and the rest. We have totally failed. 20-something percent inactive years ago, where over 56% of American adults are inactive. And the only thing that works to get people to be active is wagging their fingers. No. The only thing that works is to offer people physical spaces that invite and entice us to get out, to socialize, and to be physically active. Big study came out about a week ago, the Journal of the American Medical Association. And around Toronto, they've actually graded the various communities from low walkability to high walkability, and then they have national health. So they could look at diabetes rates. The 80% of the communities that were not walkable, diabetes kept going up and up and up like this. Obesity kept going up and up like this. For the communities that were walkable, it was flatlined or decreased. The only thing we have seen at a population level that really seems to help, we need to tax soda, by the way, but beyond that, the only thing that helps is really to get people to be physically active. And so that's why I'm honored and pleased to be with these planning leaders, because I think they're doing more than the guys in the white coats in terms of helping people to be healthy.
Well, wow, what great thoughts. And I think that the work that you have done in terms of informing us for the last several years on the severe need for parks in our urban centers, and then, Lisa, the work that you're doing of implementing, actually making that happen is really exciting. So, yeah, thrilled to be here. So I, being working for a professional sports team, I have sort of a take on parks and recreation and activity that might be a little bit different. So I wanted to share some of those thoughts with you around AT&T Park, home of the San Francisco Giants, and what we do there around public health, and for our project that we're partnered with the city of San Francisco on Mission Rock. So first, I think there's been so much thought and really excellent research done around the physical and increasingly the mental health benefits of access to parks. One thing that hasn't been studied as much is the community health benefit. And that's where we at the Giants really feel that we fit into this kind of comprehensive solution around health. There's the health of the body, there's the health of the spirit, and there's the health of the community. And when we built AT&T and brought it back to an urban center, I mean, it's many people don't know AT&T Park is actually on public land. It's the Port of San Francisco, and the public trust is over it. That's the State Lands Commission that regulates the tidelands of the entire state. And so one of our charters is to provide public access to the waterfront and to increase public engagement with our waterfront and with each other. And of course, the orientation of the ballpark out towards the bay and the connection that fans have to the waterfront and to the park system that the port has established is very significant. But when we think about health, it's also around the community. So we started early on programming community events for kind of special events that happen on a daily basis for different interest groups to come down to the ballpark and to see it as their own. So we have different heritage nights, Filipino Heritage Night, Irish Heritage Night. We just had LGBT Night on Friday as part of the Pride celebrations of the weekend. And so over the course of a season, you see all different kinds of people coming to the ballpark. It's sort of flipped on its head, this definition of what a baseball fan is. And Lisa, you touched on this earlier with respect to parks being a place that we can engage with other people and make connections across diverse groups that we might not otherwise make on our daily travels. So I think that's one of the biggest things in terms of building community health is fostering tolerance for each other and inclusion around so many different people coming and sharing a space. And that's something that we think about a lot and carrying that thread through from the ballpark into Mission Rock. Just a brief kind of overview of Mission Rock. It's a 28-acre site directly across from the ballpark. So it's also known as Lot A or Seawall Lot 337. Plenty of you have probably parked a car there. And it's currently a 28 acres of asphalt parking right on the edge of the waterfront. And so we've been working with the State Lands Commission, with the port, with the city, and with, most importantly, the neighborhood and community on defining what the future of Mission Rock is. And that does include 8 acres of parks and open space. Including this as the center of what is our fastest growing neighborhood in the city has been a very important thing. And so I'll talk a little bit about the Mission Rock parks. In order to get there, though, these land use projects take some time. We've been talking with the city and community now for about 8 years. We went to, some of you might remember if you're San Francisco voters, that last fall we had a proposition, Yes on D, Mission Rock. So it's been a long process, rightfully so, because this is such an important public piece of land. And how are we going to use those 8 acres of open space and parks? So we had a little project called the Yard at Mission Rock. In the meantime, while we're going through the entitlements and environmental studies, and the Yard is sort of a programming and a park prototype for us. And one of the things that we focus a lot on is the community experience, not just in terms of passive recreation, but in terms of engagement and bringing people down to the waterfront. And you have to really create a draw. I think you can provide the space, but then you sort of have to give people a reason and definitely a way, speaking of streets, to go to that space. So we've worked very hard with our local library in Mission Bay. We have children's programming events. The Mission Bay Library is chock full. There are waiting lists a month in advance for the Wednesday 9 a.m. reading hour with librarians. A month, you have to go on a waiting list. It's like, you know, trying to get into preschool is just to go to your library. So we've provided the library with a second space for them to be holding these events. We've worked with the Monterey Bay Aquarium to provide education around the bay and fish and wildlife and what does this mean in our society. So the education components of that programming have been really important for us, and we think about that too as we're thinking towards the future of Mission Rock. Just briefly, and I can touch on this in more detail maybe during questions if there's a specific interest, but so 28 acres is Mission Rock, 8 acres are parks and open space, and we specifically split that into several different kinds of parks, and the concept is I think we're moving away from parks as a destination and more towards open space as a lifestyle. So it's not that you have to leave your house and be headed to go to a park to specifically do something. It's that green space and public space and open space should be integrated into our lifestyle so that it's easy to walk anywhere, not just to a park. And it's safe to bicycle anywhere, not just to a park. And so we've created multiple different sizes and scales of parks within the Mission Rock footprint, which allows for different uses. It allows for different moods, different times of day, and different sizes of gatherings, all of which I think do contribute to that community health aspect of the public health question.
So I'm an architect and a sustainability consultant, and I've lived and worked in Central SoMa in Mid-Market for the last, 15 years, and the last 10 years in Mint Plaza at 5th and Mission. And for those of you that know Mint Plaza, it's next to the old historic Mint, and there's a series of old warehouses along the other side, and it used to be, a crack alley, kind of like Stevenson Alley is behind it right now. And over the last 10 years, the neighborhood has dramatically changed. I would say the haves and the have-nots are just a little closer together. I'm not sure anything has moved around. We're just living a lot closer to each other than we used to. When I first moved in, and I'm on the second floor, and I'm right above the trellis in Mint Plaza, and it hadn't filled in yet, and I was sitting there with my coffee in the window, and it's a 674-square-foot condo, not a big place. And when I moved in, the first Saturday morning, I'm sitting there in the window, happy that I moved in and living there, and this person comes around the corner behind the Mint with a big white bucket, And he takes it, and he puts it in front of the windows of the old mint, and he sits it down, and he starts taking these things out and puts them on the windowsill of the mint. And I'm trying to figure out what this guy is doing, and it's a bottle of water, and he takes this up, and the windows had been blacked out, so it had made a mirror. And this was a homeless person who was using this as his bathroom, just like we would use the bathroom to shave. And he takes out the bucket of water, and he shaves, and he cleans his hair, and he does all that, puts it back in the bucket, and goes on his way. That's our neighborhood. That is somebody who lives there just like I do and probably still lives there. When we live in the plaza, Mint Plaza is a 24/7 alive space. It is used by all sorts of people for all sorts of reasons. Google has parties there. There have been on Bastille Day when Chez Papa used to be there. They had a little quartet. They were playing on Bastille Day, and it was also the day that these dancers that come once a week, they're fire dancers that come, and that week they were doing hula hoop dancing. So there was this lovely time where instead of putting on their music, they used the Bastille band, and so there's hula hoopers dancing on one side of the plaza to this little French band during Bastille Day. It's an amazing place, and it is so San Francisco, and that is the kind of public realm that we need. There are people there that I see every day that when they're not there, I wonder if they're okay. They just happen to be people that are, you know, just like me in a different place in life. But we need more places like that. To compare and contrast, the Federal Building Plaza, which is three blocks down the street, I would say arguably equally a well-designed space, a very different style of architecture and a different space. It has concrete places that you don't want to sit on, designed so that you can't fall asleep. And in Mint Plaza, we bring out 30 to 50 orange, bright orange plastic chairs every day. And in the last 10 years, we've maybe lost 3 to 5. They have not walked. They run counter to the notion of what an architect, when you design a public space and trying to protect it and make it safe, it is the opposite of that in Mint Plaza. And so I am a big advocate, and I never would have appreciated that had I not lived there and been able to look out my window every day for the last 10 years and see this happen. That is the kind of space that we need more of. While I appreciate that parks and Golden Gate Park and the places to go out, that's important. But when you're living in cities that are getting smaller and smaller apartments and smaller condos, regardless of what they cost a square foot, you need to have spaces that are relief to be able to come out and get out of your house, whether it's up on the roof of the building, whether it's on the public realm, or it's a mix of a public-private partnership. But that's the kind of spaces that we need more of, and I'm a big advocate for making sure that every building that we design in the city has something like that and has a place for us to meet and to interact outside of where we live, because it's that social interaction that makes cities live and thrive.
Well, thank you, Bill. That's a great segue into my second question. Lisa, you talked about the role that the city is playing in trying to develop open spaces. And my question really is for Lisa, Fran, and Bill, and Dr. Jackson, I have a separate question for you. But as we think about development within the city, and as you mentioned, apartments are getting smaller, we all know about the housing crisis. How does the city ensure that, A, we're building open space that's integrated for all types of communities and for people, whether it be you like to bike, you like to walk, you like to just have access to nature? How do we ensure that we do that from a planning perspective? And then also, how do you hold the developers accountable so when there's this development, that spaces are not privatized or they're not as accessible to the overall population, and that you can have a city that has wonderful open space as well as development?
Sure, I'll take that question first. So I already discussed the importance of partnerships with diverse stakeholders, and the examples that I listed earlier were in public spaces, so in streets and in plazas, but our partnerships with private developers are just as critical. And we've been thinking for many years about how to really partner with developers to provide public amenities. So a great example of that is our POPOS requirement. And that, it's a funny word. It stands for privately owned public open spaces. SPUR has a great map of all the POPOS in downtown. So you, as a citizen, you have a right to go and have lunch there. And it's a program that came out of the downtown plan that requires that every commercial development set aside a certain amount of space for public open spaces. And we've learned through that process, you know, a number of valuable lessons, including, you know, how to make those spaces more accessible for everyone. So, for example, some of the spaces may be tucked away in lobbies or on rooftops, so they're hard to get to, and maybe people don't really feel welcome. So it's that sense of belonging that we need to create and make sure that anyone feels welcome. And so to give an example of how we're learning from those lessons, as part of the Central SOMA plan, which is a draft plan, it's also been a long 8-year process. The plan is proposing a policy that will require all new POPOs in the plan area to be at ground level and open to the street. I think another key thing, getting back to partnerships, is this idea of creating really active spaces. So as others have discussed, making sure that there are events, making sure that there are always people there and that it feels really welcoming and that there are eyes on the street. And so the city has been strategizing about how to do that through its Plaza program, which is a framework to essentially create more of these POPOs around the city and to partner each space with a nonprofit organization that is responsible for creating something like Mint Plaza. I will also say that just when we talk about how to hold developers accountable, you know, I think we have to be really critical, you know, because these are spaces that, you know, they need to be a public asset. And so being more specific about how we craft operations plans or just other kind of standards of maintenance and operation and use is really critical. And we, as many people know, have a really active civic discourse in San Francisco. And so we definitely rely on people to look at these processes and to be critical of them.
Fred and Bill, would you like to add to that? I know, Fred, you've talked about what the Giants are doing and really leading the way in this new development.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think this is a critical question, and it's one that I spend a lot of time thinking about. I feel very fortunate to work for the Giants, which is a much longer term community player in terms of our investment profile and horizon. But one of the things we do think about is how do we design future Mission Rock building owners, how do we design a framework and a system for them to be able to participate in continuing the good work that we have all started with respect to the public realm. So specifically, there are a few really fabulous public financing mechanisms that are absolutely critical. One of them is called CFD Mello-Roos. That's Community Facilities District, and we are going to be relying heavily on this. It's similar to tax increment financing, where you have an increase of property taxes, and that allows you to invest in infrastructure up front. But CFD is a little bit different because it allows the owners to self-tax themselves. It's a special tax. It's not a property tax. It's not anything that would otherwise be going to other services within the city. And you can create a community of buildings who are saying, we believe in the value of the public realm enough that we are going to invest in them, not just up front, most importantly, in the long run. Maintenance. Replacing the you know, slate paver that's gotten chipped over the years, being able to potentially respond to changing climate conditions, or where we are, most importantly, we have our CFD mechanism looking at sea level rise also. So when you're going for obligations that are long-term with developers, which we absolutely need to do, we have to also align and create financing structures where the development community can just continually be keeping pace with the requirements of the public space.
Oh, and I'll add, Mint Plaza does have a Mello-Roos. That's what.
Yes, we actually modeled it after your first one.
Oh, awesome. So, well, yeah. I contribute to that every year.
Yes, thank you.
and given everything else, it's just one more number on the list. But and I think it does make a big difference. To me, this boils down. I mean, I work for most of the developers that are working on a lot of the big projects in San Francisco. Our company does, and I can say that they all don't have the same notion about what is good design and what the value of open space versus what they can rent or what they can sell. And I'm not going to judge anybody or call anybody out, but there is an active debate, I think, that we as architects and designers need to be asking ourselves. I mean, when you go to an architect's website, I'll give this. If you go to an architect's website and you see images of all of their buildings and they don't have any people in the images, that gives you one statement about how they see and what is good
design. And nowhere to sit.
You know where to sit, right. And if you see people and you see it's a little more, you know, human, they have a different attitude about what is good design. And, you know, we can have the discussion about what is good design all night long, but that is, to me, you can learn a lot about how developers and how architects see the world, and those are the people that you want to look for in terms of whether they really understand the neighborhood and understand there's the building that they're designing and it's art as object, or whether it's art as open space or architecture creating spaces and places that we want to live in. And that it's easy to do one and harder to do the other well. So I'll add that.
You want to add to that?
So in the 1970s, the United States government passed a law, the National Environmental Policy Act. Among the things it said, you had to do an impact assessment. It didn't say you had to do just an environmental impact assessment, and it never intended that we would leave out the impact on human beings. And so we have been derelict as a society for the last 35 years in our capturing of what are the impacts on human health and well-being. Yeah, they do noise and they do dust and air stuff, but they don't do how much can people walk? How much can they socialize? How happy are they? The second most prevalent disorder in America is depression. What is it doing to make people feel better, as you just said? And over and over again, we have focused on very narrow technical engineering things and have not looked at how any kind of change. No change that any architect puts in place is without some kind of negative. Anything we do brings some kind of negative. And just as in medicine, you hope that whatever you do to someone, you optimize and do more good than harm. And I think that's really more, we should have more of that attitude as we think about development. I work at UCLA. Beverly Hills stopped the subway going under Wilshire Boulevard because it might make some noise for the people living in Beverly Hills. Well, God help me, we really need the subway under Wilshire Boulevard.
That's excellent. I just want to, for those who are listening on the radio, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program. We are discussing the impact of open space on public health. We have Lisa Chin, planner in the San Francisco Planning Department, Richard J. Jackson, doctor, professor, and former chair of environmental sciences at UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Fred Weld, vice president of strategy and development for the San Francisco Giants, and Bill Worthen, founding principal of Urban Fabric, Inc. I'm Professor Malo Hudson of UC Berkeley and your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Now we have a series of questions from the audience that are quite excellent. So far we've been discussing San Francisco, but we haven't talked about suburban communities and some of the challenges. One of the audience questions says, how can suburbs and more rural communities activate and access public park spaces? Can you talk about the low-cost, socially equitable options around this, especially you, Dr. Jackson, when you mentioned the health inequities, especially when you think about diabetes among certain populations and vulnerable populations?
The Los Angeles River runs about 55 miles through Los Angeles County. 100 years ago, Frederick Law Olmsted's sons designed a beautiful walkway, bikeway, green space, floodplains, ball fields, carriageways, you name it, to run along the Los Angeles River. It was decided that it would be turned into a concrete sluice instead, and we would build the homes, mainly of the poor, right up to the edge of the concrete sluice. The poorest, most overweight, most inactive people with the least opportunities in Los Angeles now live near the Los Angeles River. And one of the big things that had to happen was a whole new vision of what that ought to be, to open it up, to create something close to the vision that was that should have been put in place 100 years ago. Yes, it costs money, and yes, it's actually going to bring people with more money who want to live in a place where they can see blue herons and reeds and water, but the people desperately need jobs there. And they need a bicycle route to get downtown, or for that matter, to get to Long Beach and get to the ocean. that is safe, that really would be pleasant for them to be on, or a kayak route in the best of all days if you really were able to do, and it will happen. The city has put in a large amount of money. They put in a half-cent sales tax, which they're going to do another one in the next few months, that will go to a lot of these issues. Just quickly, there are some green routes that, so that is going to happen, but there are green routes that cross the river all over the place, and they're high-voltage power line rights of way. Now, in general, you don't want to be too close to high voltage, but simply going, you know, if it's 200 feet up and you're going in and out of it, and you create a linear park that goes for 5 miles, and you connect to another park that goes here, and then you go to a ball field over here and a cemetery that's now being used as a human space, you're going to begin to retrofit. And these folks desperately need, just as you said, Lisa, there are children who have never seen the ocean, and or even, for that matter, a farmer's market. And so, you know, it's going to take little things. I want to make a quick point. We focus a lot on the hardware, and I love listening to this group because you're really talking about the software. You can't build with just the hardware, the physical environment. You have to create the cultural and festival and other things that really make life worth living. We have a 1% set aside for art. When you build a state building, for example, I think there ought to be another 1% set aside for festivals and events to really make a place home.
We have a number of questions from the audience that have to do with vulnerable populations, particularly when you think about a city like San Francisco, the number of homeless, and homeless that are people who have mental illness, and also people who are homeless and on sidewalks where people may not feel safe or vulnerable. How do we address those issues of not only dealing with the real social aspects of homelessness, mental illness, whether it be in people feeling safe, but also how do you activate space where it's welcoming for all types of people from all backgrounds?
I can take that. So in preparing for tonight's talk, I did a very unscientific survey of a number of colleagues and was actually asking people to describe what they think of when they hear healthy public space, and also just to tell me what their favorite parks and open spaces are. And one theme that emerged throughout was this idea of balance, right? This idea that we want places where everyone feels welcome, but no single group dominates. And it could be whether there's homelessness issues or drug dealing, or it can be, the needs of kids versus dogs, which is another kind of conflict we see in our open spaces. So I think really the key here is to think about, really thoughtfully about how we design our spaces and what uses that will generate. And then, like I said, really thinking about the long term, thinking about how we activate those spaces and how we deal with issues that arise. So the example that I gave at Civic Center Plaza, where they've employed formerly homeless and incarcerated individuals to help steward the site, you know, they really are able to approach people with much more understanding of the situation that they're in and with compassion, and really also kind of instill this sense of, you know, this is our space. We need to share it with everyone. We want kids to be in this space too. We want seniors here. There's this concept of, designing spaces for ages 8 to 80, right? That's kind of the litmus test of whether or not it's successful. And so I think, creating that almost change in our culture and our expectations about what role our open spaces serve is really critical.
So I served several years on the Central Market Community Benefits District, the CBD Board of Directors. When you're on that board, and my partner is now, Kyle, is on the board, every month, as one of the things that we would get as a board member when we would meet, was a report. We have community guides that are in Central Market. They're not the police. They're not just people to direct tourists where they're supposed to go. That is part of what they do. And their job is to walk around the neighborhood and basically they look for graffiti. They look for anything that's going on. But their job is to get to know the people who live in the neighborhood and to provide services to those who need it, no matter what they are, whether they're a tourist or a homeless person or something else. Every month we would get reports about, we would get data, everything from how much poop was on the street, and it was characterized between human poop and not human poop, and you can tell the difference, all the way through to needles, to everything else that happened, and the stories about who needed intake and who was taken care of and what services provided. And I can tell you, reading those reports about the neighborhood that I live in every week, every month, makes you understand a lot about what really is going on in your neighborhood. And I have lived there for the last 10 years. And, you know, a lot, we're talking about stabilizing people. A lot of the time, the people that are in most need of services just need someone to show them a little hope, or someone to give them a chance, or someone to be tenacious about the fact that we're going to get you into service or get you somewhere because they're either too proud or for whatever reason. And I'm not talking about the chronic, the people that have mental health issues. That's one thing, and you know, but as a general rule, the people in the neighborhood, you know, I walk around, and to this day, I have the number in my pocket. If I see someone on the street and I ask them if they need some services, I know how to get them that service. And I've gone out with my dog on a Saturday morning and run into people in the plaza and done that. But you have to know how to engage, when to ask, when to call someone else. But to also remember that this is the neighborhood that you're in as well. So one of the things to do is to remember to understand how you can help and how you can make a difference. Because when you live in an urban neighborhood, it's not about complaining about the nightclub that's down the street. It's about the fact that you moved in next to a nightclub down the street. Accept it and celebrate it, and you know that it's going to be noisy every now and then. Same thing with homeless people. Same thing with anything else, that you need to understand who they are and that how can you bring them the services that they need. And I will put a plug in for the Central Market CBD. The guides that we have and other CBDs have them as well, really do make a difference, because they're there and that's their job, is to just be on the street and to provide help. And I think that makes a big difference.
So far, we've spoken a lot about San Francisco, and I think, Dr. Jackson, you mentioned Toronto doing some things. We have an audience question that says, what are some examples of cities and countries that are really achieving positive health results through public spaces? Is it realistic that we will see this here in San Francisco, and I'll add even the Bay Area? And that could be for Lisa. Are there good examples that we can draw upon to say this is something we might want to think about?
My video series, I visited a dozen cities around the country. The mayor of Charleston, Joe Riley, at one point, I said, well, Mr. Mayor, this city, really, you've done a wonderful job. And he said, yes, we need to build a city that's just for people to live, that's just as nice as anywhere they'd want to visit. One of the things they did, by the way, was they protected their waterfront profoundly. They put in two high-quality cuisine schools of cooking, which has just improved the tone of the place. Yeah, you get a lot of tourists, but even so, you feel very safe walking around that town. Obviously, Boulder and Colorado and Portland, Minneapolis is the most bikeable city in the United States, which is kind of shocking when you think about just how delightful the weather is there in the winter. But a lot of it it's top down, because you really do have to have the leadership from the top, and the boss has got to think this is important. And it's bottom up. It's the community saying, this is the community we want. We live here and we're committed to it. One city that gives me a lot of hope, and people think I'm crazy, is Detroit. It was pretty tumble down downtown. They brought back the Eastern Market, which was a big food transfer center, and now it's become really a heart of that city. They turned the Campus Martius. The worst thing they did was build these high towers that looked like corn cobs, shiny corn cobs, that was going to be the Renaissance Center. That was a complete failure. But the more they're bringing actually real people in there, and the philanthropies and the hospitals have really stepped up very well. And, a lot of international buying is going into Detroit, because with climate change, all that fresh water, there's lots of reasons why Detroit is a very smart place to buy. Mm-hmm. So, and they've got a general plan with 12 different elements on how to fix that city. California has come up with a new general plan that's got a very strong, general plan just means the Constitution for Growth. It's very strong on equity and social justice. So I think we're going to see more change here, too.
I would add to that, and I'm born and raised in Boston, so it pains me to say this, but I think New York has done a fabulous job of those smaller interventions that can really provide hope when you're looking at a city-wide or a region-wide effort, because not everyone can have the opportunity to re-envision 28 acres on their waterfront and plan 8 acres of that to be open space, right? I mean, many of our cities in the United States, particularly on the East Coast, post-industrial areas are built out. So the question is, to Lisa's early statement about 25% of the urban area being made of streets, what do we do with what we're left with? So New York, under Amanda Burden's leadership, took this fabulous approach of intersections and making a more pedestrian focus rather than a vehicular focus. And I think that's made a world of difference. I mean, without that, they wouldn't have had the city bike share program. Without that, you're looking at more and more people in those cars and on the freeways. So I think that has been an inspiration from a network scale perspective rather than an individual project.
Great. I want to piggyback off what was just said. Certainly when we think about climate change and the challenges we're all facing, cities are growing. The world is becoming much more urbanized. As you mentioned, Lisa, the streets take up about 25% of the city. And if we start thinking about suburbanization, just given the rising housing costs here in the Bay Area, people moving further and further away, we have an audience question that ties into something I was thinking about. Since this event is sponsored by the California Wellness Foundation, please address the additional health effects of green living spaces, of really creating green living spaces, compared to the barren concrete man-made spaces that we have now, or human-made spaces that we have. So does anyone want to talk about thinking outside the box? This is San Francisco. Can we be more innovative in how we think about how we develop, not only as a city, but as a region? When we think about green living spaces, whether it be rooftop gardens, taking back some of the street, taking some of the streets away and making it more natural, freeing up some of our rivers and creeks.
Bill, I'm going to defer to you, but quickly, a lot of the building that was done 15 years ago to be sustainable, low carbon footprint, energy efficient, in my opinion, was pretty ugly. It really didn't have terrific design to it. And I think the more that we've inserted human beings into the whole sustainability design, where it was radical to put stairways in the entry to a building instead of the elevators right there. And now most new buildings put stairways and want people to take the stairs. One flight of stairs a day for a year is about a pound of body fat burned off. So this is a good thing. But it also creates socialization and ways for people ways for people to be together and to connect. But number two, I mean, it's crazy to have God's sunlight coming through the windows and through the roof of the place and to be burning fossil fuels when we ought to be capturing the indirect daylight in the building. And I can never figure out in San Francisco, the nicer the day, the poorer the air quality in a building. And I think it's because they shut off the ventilation if it's really nice out because they figure don't need heat or cold.
100% outside air.
Yeah, and so we're not using the what we've got. But I'm seeing real changes. I get a lot of enthusiasm and optimism from my students and the young people coming up because they do understand this linkage.
So we're working on several projects, I would say, that are trying to push the envelope in this world, but in the notion of what is good green design or sustainability. The more that we are living in smaller spaces, the more you want to have good spaces. Right. It's not about cheapest, fastest, it's about best value. And so taking the time to actually design a space that is very well designed and usable, but smaller and has green, whether it's a living wall, literally a green space, or that is being designed to actually purify the air. We're now working on a couple of projects, including some things at SFO, where we've looked at, can we use those plants to actually purify the air as they come in, as the air moves through the space. That we have the technology to do all of that. We also have the technology to now take our waste, turn it into fuel, turn that into biogas, use that to heat and cool our buildings, and actually make that something that you can actually understand and see. Or even have a waste treatment plant also be the yoga facility for the neighborhood. All of those things exist, and I could point you to buildings that do that. But it takes a thoughtful architect and a thoughtful developer that isn't, I hate the phrase, highest and best use. Highest and best don't, best and highest, you can have a big debate about what that means. But when we talk about what that means in terms of building a livable city, we need to have spaces that actually work, and people don't tear down buildings they love. So how do you design those kind of spaces? I think that's the key.
Can I just say, One of the causes of homelessness is we don't have enough homes. And poor people need places to live. And what we've done in the past in the U.S. from World War II on is we built affordable housing that was really dreadful. It did not have decent ventilation, sight lines, sound insulation, the things that make landscaping, ventilation, you know, the things that make a place pleasant to, for people to live. And then we wonder why people don't respect and love the place they're in.
Yes.
And I just wanted to add on to that. Well, first of all, I want to say I wish that all architects were as thoughtful as you are, Bill. So we, as a city, have been thinking about how to integrate green spaces into both new and existing buildings, including our public housing stock. So the city has a Better Roofs program, which was recently adopted at the board. It was sponsored by Supervisor Wiener.
Yes.
And it requires a certain amount of solar on rooftops, but there will be an alternative compliance option, which will allow for green roofs, which is great.
Yes.
So that will set the floor, but we really want people to push the envelope and go for these more innovative options. And then to your point about public housing, the city is also in the process of a rental assistance demonstration project, which is revitalizing public housing. And I'm working on a project in partnership with Chinatown Community Development Center, where they're actually taking ownership of four public housing projects that are really as you described. You know, they need a lot of help in terms of not just increasing the environmental performance, but making the units more habitable for people. So there's a lot of indoor air quality issues. There's a lot of wasted energy that goes into heating and cooling the spaces. And so as part of that project, CCDC is trying to push the envelope and think about what sorts of improvements can they add to the buildings that will not only make them more efficient, but also increase access to open space and just make it more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Great. We've talked about the possibilities that exist, but one of the things we haven't talked about is the reality, the fiscal reality of some of these challenges. So I recently got back from London, where I was in a meeting, a week-long meeting about the circular economy and the importance of having walkable spaces and parks and all these things, as well as buildings. And then we got into the issues of, well, how do you finance it? So, friend, being with the San Francisco Giants, have you thought about financing this? I mean, obviously, having a 28-acre development in one of the most expensive cities in the world, you're taking away, you know, you could have put houses there. And there are a number of questions from the audience that are in my lap saying, how do you balance between the housing crisis and the housing reality versus open space, and how do you finance that?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and we did go round and around and around with different pro formas of land use scenarios and thinking through all of that. I think that someone earlier mentioned balance within parks as an indicator of the success of that park. And I would say the same thing for neighborhoods. So balance within neighborhoods as an indicator of the success of the neighborhood. So we took the approach that a mix of uses was the most valuable and the most sustainable. So we have housing, we also have office space, we also will have restaurants, and we also will have parks. And we think as a community, we've come together and said all of those things are important enough. So sort of technically to answer your question, the property taxes that come off of and other taxes that the buildings pay, that the high-value commercial space in particular pays, allows us to build the parks and the affordable housing. Mission Rock has 40% affordable housing on site, which is the highest ever in the city of San Francisco. And the reason we have that is because we have all of this valuable land. And we said we're going to dedicate the fees coming off of the valuable commercial land to help support the other uses that make a whole community. I am also a very strong believer from the development and investment perspective that parks create higher value of the buildings adjacent to them. Not only parks and great, well-maintained, well-programmed parks, but well-curated retail and experiences along the ground floor. So I think that the environment You know, cities are all competing for talent. They're all competing for investment. We're going against London. We're going against Dubai. You know, these are the people who are making these decisions. And so it's about placemaking and spacemaking. And if you have that, I truly believe it drives value. We say upstairs, right? So it's a, sort of the ground floor as the generator of value and the upstairs floors 2 through X as sort of the recipients of that. So I think you have to look at it from an ecosystem perspective in a neighborhood.
Bill, you're doing it through your firm. How do you create incentives for people, or if you're advising others to do this type of work?
Well, I'll give you a quick story. We worked on a project, it's actually at my previous firm, but I think the story is a good one. It's a project called Casa Feliz, First Community Housing. It's down in San Jose. You can look it up. That project, low-income housing, and it needed a stormwater improvement because of the building. We needed to upsize the storm sewer. $250,000 improvement that wasn't in the budget. So we looked at it and we said, well, what if we put a green roof on the building that would soak up the water so you didn't need to put in that green roof? Went to the city, showed them all the math. Rana Creek did the work with us. And the green roof, and the city bought off on the numbers, so we didn't have to do that stormwater improvement by putting a green roof on the building. Mm-hmm. The green roof cost $150,000, so we just saved the client $100,000 right there through a sustainable design feature that actually would make the building better. We then went and found a grant for a habitat for to put in a create the right species as a habitat for butterflies, and got the roof paid for.
Great.
So that's how you can do it if you think creatively and don't think old school, siloed construction, design and construction. You've got to look at your resources and how can you use water, share water, turn energy into power, poop to power, all those things exist right now. And that's the world that we're in. So I could talk about things like that all day long or all night long.
But I would add one thing too on that, which it sounds like you had a great collaborative team approach. And I think one thing that's changing as we think about healthy space, healthy place, sustainable buildings and cities is the more multidisciplinary approach. And I know you've worked on this in your, you know, teaching of we can't be siloed as teams, developer, architect, city, you know,
or planning, agency, design, and occupancy. Those are the three. Real RE and AEC need to actually work more together.
So
and that's the missing link right now.
You don't see the efficiencies until you have those conversations.
Yes.
I think we're at a code blue. I mean, when you look at more energy, there's more energy in the atmosphere. There's more heat in the atmosphere. Look at this heat wave out here. Anything we do that can cool the environment, and that green roof goes a long way to that, captures rain, and as adding, removing CO2 and adding oxygen, it's all to the good. It's what we ought to be doing.
And I think the thing that's hard is that none of this has to, if you have $1 million to build a building, you should still only spend $1 million to build a building. The buckets of money that you're going to put it in, design fees, hard costs, soft costs, the cost of the curtain wall, if you take your old, the way it's always been done for the last 50 years and look at what you think as a design professional that that wall should cost, what I'm talking about is going to cost more and you're going to try to get that number back down. But you're going to eliminate something else. And you, so it's moving money into different buckets, but the whole doesn't need to change. But you have to know how to talk. You need to know how to communicate, need how to think creatively. And that's the part that can be missing on a lot of project teams is we go back to what we're comfortable with and we're afraid to take risk.
Mm-hmm. You mean the 20th century is over?
Yeah.
Lisa, really quickly, if you can just tell me from the city's perspective, what are you doing around public health as well? So you're in the planning department, but are you working across, breaking down these silos that Fran had just mentioned? Mm-hmm. Are you working with public health? Are you working with other departments to think of this holistically?
Yeah, that is really such a key issue that we're trying to deal with, is how to break down these institutional silos, not just between planning and health, but really across all agencies. So, you know, just thinking about our streetscapes, for example, you know, DPW is in charge of the streets, and there are other agencies in charge of lighting and signs, and just thinking about all the different moving pieces is really, it's a challenge, it's a puzzle that we deal with every day. I really think that there are opportunities to work more closely with public health in particular, because they are some of these creative, out-of-the-box thinkers who can provide the data and the evidence for why these are really important investments to make in our cities. Here in San Francisco, we have a very progressive health department, and they've created all these tools that have really illustrated what the impact is of the environment on our health. So they were very involved in the Vision Zero project, project, which was this interagency process to identify the corridors where the greatest number of injuries and fatalities are happening for pedestrians and bikes. And that has led directly to investments in our infrastructure to help make a difference and bring those numbers down. So I think it comes to, as others have said, you know, leadership, but also just being really willing to say, you know, I don't have all the answers,
yes.
Which is very hard for us professionals to do and for us planners to do in particular. But I have seen that people have really gotten a lot out of those partnerships in San Francisco and in cities around the country.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in the program where there's time for only one last question. And Dr. Jackson, I want to give it to you because you were talking about the real health benefits, potential health benefits of creating open spaces and parks and whatnot. What are one or two things you think we could do, whether it be, you know, across multiple sectors or whatnot, to really have an impact on addressing our obesity issue as well as the inequities that we see, especially among vulnerable populations?
One third of Americans don't drive. They're too young, too old, poor, disabled. And I think perhaps pushing walking, pushing bicycling, pushing active transportation up much higher. And because in the 20th century, we thought our job was to meet the needs of the cars. It was 25% of the entire economic engine of the United States. Those days are over. Even with autonomous cars, we've got to begin to put people first. And if we do it that way, we will end up doing the right thing.
Wonderful. Thanks to our panelists, Lisa Chen, planner in the San Francisco Planning Department, Dr. Richard J. Jackson, professor and former chair of environmental sciences at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health, Fran Weld, vice president of strategy and development for the San Francisco Giants, and Bill Worthen, founding principal of Urban Fabric, Inc. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. I'm Professor Malo Hudson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.